For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, with the latest readout video from our free email Wednesday Wake Up newsletter, to which you should subscribe so we can stay in touch in case we get deplatformed, even though we're doing very well on YouTube, thanks partly to those viewers in San Jose, California, who've made their city number 33 on our all-time viewing list. And speaking of getting deplatformed, from time to time we have bewailed those corporate leaders, especially in the energy industry, who've tried to appease climate radicals in the apparent belief that if they pretend to agree that oil and gas should be eliminated, the government will pretend to eliminate them. Now they've found out that the people who claim to want their companies dead actually do, including in Canada, where the Trudeau administration just passed Bill C-59, which legal scholar Bruce Pardee calls, quote, a hodgepodge bill of humdrum provisions hundreds of pages long, end quote, in which lurks one of the most extraordinary attacks on free speech that this country has ever seen, and an attack that is aimed directly at any hydrocarbon energy company that dares defend itself. The critical provision is a draconian ban on greenwashing, which in this context doesn't mean making false claims of environmental virtue, it means making pretty much any claims of environmental virtue. As Pardee explains, quote, businesses cannot claim that their products or practices help to protect against climate change or provide other environmental benefits unless they can prove the claims are true, end quote. This provision shamelessly reverses the traditional onus of proof on those who allege wrongdoing. And now, if, for instance, you want to say that Canadian natural gas exports would help reduce emissions in countries that switch from coal, you're not just going to have to run the kinds of model simulations that alarmists do all the time, you're going to have to prove every one of your assumptions in court, whereas they don't have to prove theirs at all, or you will face ruin, including possible fines of 3% of your gross worldwide income if, ironically, it turns out not to be possible to prove with absolute certainty precisely how much extra revenue that you earned because of the impugned claim. And we're pleased to report that firms seem to have clued in to the drastic nature of this measure, at least partway. Law firms are issuing scary notices, and, as Pardee's piece explains, quote, companies and industry associations have taken down climate pledges and environmental commitments from their websites and social media, end quote, including the Pathways Alliance, a group of major Canadian oil sands companies that championed appeasement and which has now decided, according to the CBC, quote, to remove all the content from its website, social media, and other public communications, end quote. Now, in doing so, they're still pleading that they're one of the cool kids, but the cool kids want nothing to do with them except to stomp them flat. So, all those fancy oil and gas company communications departments full of perky young things drafting online statements about how you were knuckling under with classic corporate efficiency have turned out to be a waste of time, money, and groveling. So we say it's time to cut it out and support CDN instead. Hey there, just a quick reminder about subscriptions. We're this close to 100,000, so if you have already subscribed, thank you very much and enjoy the programs. If you haven't, click the button here, get us to 100,000 and beyond. And now, back to me. And speaking of businesses being surprised that the crocodile ate them, in Australia, energy producers are shocked to find that natural gas is going to be phased out in an effort to get rid of carbon-based fuels. What did they expect? Even if it was just that they'd be the last ones to be killed, objects in calendar are closer than they appear. And if we're all going to reach net zero by 2050, well, that's barely 25 years away now, so past the shroud. Or the cooking pot. What's at stake in this particular Australian episode is a green rating system that would affect capital investment, as governments around the world that learned firmly that central planning doesn't work are now rushing to implement it anyway. But it's also very much a chickens for KFC story because, for instance, the story says, quote, the Australian understands the Business Council of Australia, which had a representative on the taxonomy advisory panel, was pushing for gas to be included as a transition asset in the draft framework, end quote. So, someone from the Business Council thought that being in there helping to plan the menu would help keep them off it. Except for the part where they agree to be served as the main course. Quote, Business Council of Australia Chief Executive Bran Black said gas was a transition fuel that helps us get to net zero by 2050, end quote. Which any fool can see, or should be able to see means no natural gas by 2050, as it is CH4. And the C is for carbon. So, what barnyard fowl endorses all nuggets all the time and is then surprised to be promptly battered and fried? In the newsletter, we also note that, untethered from facts, climate alarmists are now following Icarus on a perilous flight path. Canada's Environment and Climate Change Minister, Stephen Guilbeault, recently X'd out, quote, "Results are in. June heat waves in central and eastern Canada were 7 to 10 degrees Celsius above average due to climate change. Environment.ca is now assessing how human-caused climate change impacts severe weather," end quote. 10 degrees Celsius above average? So that 33 degrees Celsius heat wave would have been 23 degrees without climate change? The attribution crowd has tried to make these claims before, and they've always melted on close inspection. And we have a new slogan, Go Woke, Go Dark. Minnesota has mandated that all electric utilities produce only carbon-free electricity by 2040, and they mean it, as in, they are clueless nits. Quote, "Carbon-free means a technology that generates electricity without emitting carbon dioxide," end quote. Which, of course, no energy source does, since, at a minimum, they all use cement, which emits carbon dioxide, as do their employees. What's more, at least one Minnesota company, Xcel, provides power to a lot of people in neighboring South Dakota, whose Public Utilities Commission has asked Xcel not to close coal-fired plants early because it may cause blackouts in their state. Plus, Minnesota buys power from North Dakota, which has warned that refusing to do so because of how it's generated violates the Constitution, specifically the Commerce Clause, and conflicts with the Federal Power Act and infringes the authority of the EPA. So, you've got a nasty fight brewing over a disastrous policy. Great, what a transition. Mind you, it is working for some people. It's in fact surprisingly easy to collect examples of climate alarmist hypocrisy, such as Canada's Ambassador for Climate Change, Catherine Stewart, billing over $250,000 in travel expenses in under 2 years, jetting from Abu Dhabi to Amsterdam to Bali and on through the alphabet, including London, Milan, Paris, Rome, and Zurich. And she's not traveling steerage either. And that one was immediately followed by news that the, quote, "leading opponent of fossil fuels," end quote, in Canada's appointed Senate, that's Rosa Galvez of Quebec, quote, "jetted more than 100,000 kilometers to climate conferences from Casablanca to Mumbai," end quote, in the past year. And we do grant a certain role to human frailty here. But it's also plain that the people calling for a dramatic change in how we live are imagining a world in which there's no change in how they live. They won't be the ones making sacrifices, because they're convinced that whatever resources are available, they and their anointed fellows will be getting a heaping helping, while we ordinary schleps will give up stuff that we couldn't appreciate anyway. So, we'll have nothing, and they'll be partying. And another thing, we often hear that sea levels are rising much faster in some places than others, and that the rate in the fast-rising places is proof of climate change. Almost as if the world's oceans were not all connected, or that sinking land in some places was irrelevant to the phenomenon. As one sarcastic viewer asked, quote, "So, apparently ships have to go uphill as they approach cities where the sea is rising so much more rapidly than in other places," end quote. And another thing, the Economist piece that we cited last week on how, quote, "the Venice of Africa is sinking into the sea," end quote, did concede that, quote, "The major cities built by European colonial powers a century or more ago are nearly all found on fragile sandy shores, often among lagoons and mangrove estuaries at the mouths of rivers used for transport and trade," end quote. Right. So, if such places sink into the swamp, give some credit to the swamp, and also to post-colonial standards of infrastructure maintenance. But don't give any to reporters' research skills. Speaking of which, the Atlantic Weekly Planet piece that we cited last week, celebrating the deadliness of Hurricane Beryl, links to a story saying, quote, "Beryl is on track to be the strongest hurricane to hit the southernmost windward islands on record, and the most intense for the area since Hurricane Ivan 20 years ago. Parts of the easternmost Caribbean have never experienced a hurricane with such ferocity in records going back nearly 174 years, end quote. So, we don't know what happened before. Unless we have internet access, and can find Wikipedia saying, quote, the Great Hurricane of 1780 was the deadliest Atlantic hurricane on record, as well as the deadliest tropical cyclone in the Western Hemisphere. An estimated 22,000 people died throughout the Lesser Antilles when the storm passed through the islands from October 10th to October 16th. Specifics on the hurricane's track and strength are unknown, but still, we do know that it was the deadliest ever, even though the population at the time was far, far lower than it is today. And we know that those who did survive said it was a monster. Quote, the hurricane struck Barbados likely as a Category 5 hurricane, with at least one estimate of wind gusts as high as 200 miles per hour, 320 kilometers per hour. Coming in the midst of the American Revolution, the storm caused heavy losses to the British fleet contesting for control of the area, end quote. And here's something else that we know, or should know, quote, the hurricane was part of the disastrous 1780 Atlantic hurricane season, with two other deadly storms occurring in October, end quote. Oh my, a bad hurricane season before the Industrial Revolution? Are those allowed? In this week's newsletter, we wrapped up our series on Professor Quingbin Liu's CRE model of climate change by discussing the sixth data point that Liu says shows that his model does much better than the IPCC's CO2 model for explaining man-made climate change. The Arctic, Antarctic, and the UK's Central England Temperature CET series. Now, the CET record is useful because the UK had a lot of air pollution during its history, especially after the Industrial Revolution, but it's had much less since the 1950s. So, the effects of aerosol cooling have worn off, which means that, according to orthodoxy, CO2 warming should now dominate. But instead, the CET shows rapid warming from about 1975 to 2000, but a leveling off afterwards. And the polar regions are the other test area, partly because of their differences. The Arctic is mostly ocean, while the Antarctic is mostly land. The Arctic did experience some aerosol pollution prior to 2000, but isolated Antarctica really didn't. And the Antarctic sea ice boundary has hardly changed at all, whereas the warming amplifying effect of ice retreat should affect the Arctic record. Despite all these considerations, the CO2 model predicts steady warming in all three locations: England, the Antarctic, and the Arctic. But the CRE model predicts leveling off and transition to cooling after 2000, except in the Arctic. And yet again, these patterns are the ones that are actually shown in the data. Also, this week, our look at Dr. Patrick Brown's essay on the social feedback loop in climate science continued by tackling the myth of science-based policymaking and showing that it's much more a case of policy-based science-making. And the main exhibit here is that 2 degrees Celsius limit so beloved of climate activists and now enshrined in international treaties. As Brown shows, it did not emerge from the science. Instead, it was always a political fiction. And even when scientists have tried to say reasonably sensible things about it, the activists ignore them and push their rhetoric even harder. All in the name of following the science, you see. And finally this week, from the CO2Science.org archive, some lovely nutritious veggies. Specifically, black-eyed peas. There were 24 studies from 1984 to 2019 providing evidence of the growth effects of 300 parts per million of extra CO2, and the average biomass gain was 41.7%, while one study looked at a 600 part per million increase and yielded 100% gain in biomass, meaning you might not like peas, but they like your CO2. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I believe in freedom of speech.